If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. And if you haven't had a chance to get hold of our magazine recently, we'd like to offer you the chance to get a copy of our next issue absolutely free. Please text the word HISTORY to 78070 to request your free magazine today. One of our team will be in touch to organise delivery direct to your door. This offer is available for a limited time only and only available for UK residents. So please don't miss out. Text HISTORY to 78070 to get your free copy today. Just a quick note, texts are normally charged at your standard network rate. Please check with your provider for further details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. I'm Rob Attar, the magazine's editor. Today's interview is with the historian Hannah Rose Murray. She's written a piece in our August issue, On Sale Now, in which she tells the stories of African-American abolitionists who travelled to Britain in the 19th century to seek support for their campaigns against slavery in the US. And this was also the subject of this discussion, with questions put to her by our world history editor, Matt Elton.
Your research explores a perhaps surprising area of British history, doesn't it? What do you explore?
So my research looks at African Americans coming over to the British Isles during the 19th century, primarily the 1840s, 1850s and 1860s. And these women and men were born into slavery in the southern states of the US, and they travelled thousands of miles and gave hundreds of thousands of speeches all the way around the British Isles. And it's really no exaggeration to say they gave thousands of speeches. They were speaking in small villages like Ventnor on the Isle of Wight. They were speaking in Bakewell and the Peak Districts in Keswick. They were speaking in Inverness, as well as some of the larger towns and cities around Britain and Ireland as well. Obviously, London, Manchester, Birmingham, Sheffield, Edinburgh, the places that we might associate with abolition or with large meetings. And in doing so, they were trying to convince and educate the British and Irish public about slavery, how that was a system that was sustained by torture, rape, racism, white supremacy, and trying to convince them through exhibiting sort of whips of torture and instruments of torture as well, like chains and manacles, to sort of illustrate that brutality.
Mm. This is something I knew nothing about. How many people travelled from the States to Britain? And do we know how they got here? Was it an organised thing? How did it work?
So that's a great question. We don't know for sure how many people were coming over. Some historians like Richard Blackett have estimated that about 150 people came over across the 19th century. People were coming obviously in the 1840s, but they were still coming sort of after slavery had legally been abolished as well in the 1880s and the 1890s. And in terms of their tours, they were coming sometimes individually and sometimes through organised sort of abolitionist societies or networks. So sometimes they were supported by a specific anti-slavery society, like the American Anti-Slavery Society, led by William Lloyd Garrison in the US. Sometimes they were supported by Canadian anti-slavery societies. And usually, if they were supported by a specific society or they knew contacts or British abolitionists, then that tended to mean that their tour was likely to be more successful. So, for example, Frederick Douglass, who is the best example when we talk about transatlantic abolition and people who were coming over, he was supported by Garrison and the American Anti-Slavery Society. Garrison had numerous British friends and contacts across Britain and Ireland. So Douglass was able to stay in places like Dublin with Richard D. Webb. He was staying in Bristol with the Esslin family, in Newcastle with the Richardson family, and they were able to organise meetings for him in churches, local town halls, sometimes getting the fee for the town hall waived. And obviously, if you had that support, then, you know, they were likely to know newspaper editors as well, who could then write a favourable coverage of their speech, and that sort of maximised publicity for the anti-slavery cause, and also reverberated back to the US as well. But it meant that their journeys were a lot more successful. Whereas if you compare it to some individuals like Moses Roper, who came over first in the late 1830s, he did actually have anti-slavery support by chiefly George Thompson, who's one of the most famous British abolitionists. But later on, there was a bit of a falling out with him in the British abolitionist movement. And he's had to sort of go around Britain on his own, which meant that his tour in terms of the newspaper coverage and the amount of people that he could reach was somewhat limited.
We should probably set this in the context of what was happening with slavery, I suppose, both in Britain and in America. How had abolition developed by the time we reached the period we're talking about here?
Yeah, so basically in Britain, the British government in Britain had abolished the slave trade in 1807, and slavery in the British Empire by the end of the 1830s, although slavery did actually still exist in some parts of the empire. In terms of the US, slavery had existed in the Americas since the 16th century, and slavery wasn't actually legally abolished in the US until 1865, which is why you see a large majority of women and men coming over in the 1840s and 1850s and 1860s. And there are a couple of spikes, if you like, in the kind of movement. So you had in 1850, the US passed possibly one of the most draconian laws in its history, called the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, which basically gave the US government and people federal power to drag formerly enslaved people who had perhaps escaped to the North or Canada back into the jaws of slavery. So after that, there were several activists who actually came over to Britain to live because they were able to live without that fear of being dragged back into slavery. But it also created a wave of abolitionist support and also conflict in the US, as you can imagine, but particularly in the UK in terms of support for that. And also you had the Civil War between 1861 and 1865, and that also led to quite a large wave of African Americans coming over to really educate the British public about why the Civil War was being fought, that the Confederacy, so the southern states that had succeeded from the Union, were and had succeeded because of slavery. There was a lot of misinformation and propaganda and just general ignorance about why the Civil War had been fought in Britain at the time, was being fought at the time. And men and women who had experienced slavery, who had experienced torture and sexual abuse, had come all the way over to the UK to say, the South do not fight for the freedom that they are espousing. They fight for slavery and perpetuation of white supremacy.
And why did these people choose Britain and Ireland specifically to come to?
Okay, so they came to Britain and Ireland for numerous reasons. So obviously the main one is there's a shared language there. And one of the things that they did when they came to the British Isles was publish their narratives. And slave narratives were a form of protest literature. You can go and find them online. There's lots that you can read for free. And these slave narratives were given sort of English editions as well. They were published in places like London and Edinburgh and Dublin. And even actually in Welsh, Moses Roper's slave narrative was published in Welsh, which is really exciting. And as I mentioned, because of the sort of shared connections between Britain, British and American abolitionists, you had the same connections between societies. So if they were sharing or donating money to a particular society in Britain, that could be sent back to their friends and connections in the US. Again, I mentioned Garrison. This is probably the best example. Garrison had loads of friends in the UK who were collecting donations on part of the American Anti-Slavery Society, and those donations were collected at meetings that were given by African Americans. So that's a really key thing. One of the other things as well is that African Americans sometimes encouraged a boycott of slave-produced goods. So men like Henry Highland Garnet and James Watkins were telling their audiences and saying that, you know, you are wearing blood-soaked cotton, because in the 1850s you had you know, 90% of the cotton that was imported into Liverpool was slave grown. So you had that kind of connection to American slavery. You know, Garnet and Watkins were saying that you shouldn't be eating rice, you shouldn't be wearing that cotton, you shouldn't be, you know, consuming sugar. And if you really cared about, you know, their, as they said it, their oppressed brethren all the way over in the US who were toiling in slavery, then you wouldn't be using or associating yourself with those items.
And what can we tell about how these formerly enslaved people felt about the experiences of coming to this strange new country and of meeting these people?
Yeah, because they wrote a lot about it, it's actually really, really wonderful reading and really, in a way, easy to tell. So a lot of the reactions that African-American women and men had when they came to Britain and Ireland was their immediate reaction was there is an absence of extreme racism. Now, I'll say up front that racism did exist in the British Isles. Discrimination did exist. They did experience said racism and discrimination. There were African-American men and women who came over who tried to get a job in Britain and they were barred because of their colour. However, some of the more sort of famous lecturers, again, like Frederick Douglass or William Moss Brown, Henry Highland Garnet, they liked to say, I have not experienced racism in this country, because it was a performative tactic to set up a deliberate comparison between the UK and the US. They had to go thousands of miles away abroad outside of their own country where they were born to experience what they called, you know, their first sense of freedom and citizenship compared to the US. So Frederick Douglass liked to say that he could eat wherever he wanted, he could sit in a church wherever he wanted, there wasn't a so-called Negro pew as there was in the US. He could travel around, sort of experience of mobility was just so far beyond what he'd experienced in the US. And when he gave lectures across the eastern United States, he was mobbed, he was beaten, he was nearly murdered in 1843. So there was a stark difference there. Many of them experienced very sort of warm and cherished friendships with British and Irish abolitionists, some for the rest of their lives. They corresponded until the day they died. They had created these really sort of strong relationships that sustained each other, you know, for the rest of their lives. And the other thing as well we have to remember is that, as I mentioned, there were some individuals who did come over to the UK, and while most of them in their lectures were sort of saying that they didn't experience racism or congratulating the UK on abolishing slavery, again, that can be seen as a performative tactic, they also in their lectures said, well, yes, you did abolish slavery, but you had to pay compensation to enslavers. Where was the compensation for the enslaved? And there were men like Samuel Ward who said to a York audience in 1854, and he said, the land of England has been reddened with the blood of my race. And he's really getting into these sort of narratives of colonialism, imperialism, but also, again, that kind of language of blood that the British and Irish public were actually connected to slavery in so many different ways that they hadn't considered before.
You've mentioned a couple of sort of performative techniques that people used. Do we get a sense of what it must have been like to go and watch one of these talks? Were there other techniques? Were there other things that they did to help bring people on board?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I could talk for hours about this because obviously, you know, considering the amount of people that were coming over and giving these lectures, there were so many different tactics that, you know, these black men and women were using. So you had people like Moses Roper, who would exhibit instruments of torture, so whips, manacles, chains, as I mentioned earlier. Sometimes he would actually exhibit his own scarred and mutilated back to really illustrate the brutality of slavery. You had people like Henry Box Brown, who is sort of famous in this field for his miraculous escape from slavery. He basically was born enslaved just outside of Richmond in Virginia, and he posted himself in a box from Richmond all the way to Freedom in Philadelphia. Now, he found that he was a gifted entertainer and sort of virtuoso of the entertainment stage. So he exhibited that box in the US, and then he brought that box over to the UK, and he did all sorts of performative things with it. He exhibited the box, he put himself into the box again and boxed himself up on a train between Bradford and Leeds, and then sort of came out of the box in this sort of, you know, sort of kind of performative Jack in the Box almost. And he starred in plays based on his own life and also plays and performances that were related to slavery as well. He also exhibited what was called a panorama. So really what we could see as a form of early cinema. There was this huge painting on 1,000 feet of canvas that was basically rolled from one side of a theatre to another to kind of portray the sense of movement. And there were other panoramas that were being sort of shown and exhibited on the London stage. And some of them looked at the Mississippi River, for example, and how lovely the South looked. And Henry Box Brown created a panorama that showed the history of slavery, because he said, you look at these panoramas of the Mississippi River, they are deliberately missing and deliberately choosing not to focus on the history of slavery. So I will show you my history of slavery. I will show you the history of my ancestors who were kidnapped by Europeans and obviously taken over to the US. So he was showing panoramas. Ellen Craft, who is one of my favorite people from history. I urge everyone to go and look her up and read her story. But she escaped slavery with her husband in Georgia. Now, Ellen had quite a fair complexion because of the rape of her mother by her enslaver. And William and Ellen decided to basically dress Ellen in a gentleman's clothing. So she was crossing the boundaries of race, of class, of gender, and also physical ability, because enslaved people were forbidden to learn to read and write. And in order for William and Ellen to escape slavery, they had to obviously sign their name for tickets, which she couldn't do. So she bandaged her right arm to pretend that she couldn't write. But anyway, so they managed to enact this incredible escape attempt, and they actually settled over in the UK for nearly 20 years and raised 5 children here in freedom. And Ellen and William would go all the way around the UK, and William would give a lot of obviously anti-slavery speeches and things like that. And sometimes her portrait, her image dressed as that gentleman, as that white enslaver, was sold at the end of meetings. And sort of the last story I'll quickly tell is about Frederick Douglass, and I'm sure we'll get into him in a little bit, but he was excellent at oratory. He had this ability to use blistering rhetoric to convince the British and Irish public about not only how they were connected to slavery, but how at that very moment in which he was speaking to the audience in which he was speaking to, there were 3 or 4 million black men, women and children who were toiling in slavery. He knew what they suffered because he had suffered that feeling. And he was so adept at being able to persuade people about what that felt like, although obviously his minority white audience could never feel what it was to be enslaved.
That's an interesting point, actually. Do we know what kinds of people came to these kinds of talks, and do we know what their reactions were like?
Yeah, so the short answer to your question is everyone came. So you looked at these men and women were speaking to upper class audiences, sometimes aristocratic gatherings, and sometimes either in, you know, even sort of in the homes of their wealthy patrons. They were speaking to sort of middle class merchants and printers, but they were also speaking to working class audiences, sometimes specifically organizing meetings for the working classes. So Henry Box Brown, I mentioned, he would often sell tickets for his meetings, but he would give discounted rates for working class women and men. The other thing as well that's really important to note is that African Americans were also speaking to children's audiences. So sometimes they on a Sunday, there would be like a Sunday school, or there would be a specific gathering organized of children, and they would speak for an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and they would tell children their stories. And that happened again in Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales, and they would use these meetings to really try and encourage these children to grow up as abolitionists, to sort of create a legacy of further abolitionist agitation, and to grow up not showing the prejudices of perhaps their parents, friends, or leaders in their community had perhaps shown. Mm.
And how do people respond?
Yes. Yeah, so again, depending on the subject of the lecture and the particular person, the response is varied. Largely as a whole, these African-American activists were incredibly popular. They packed out town halls, churches, any kind of venue, even sometimes sort of outside spaces. You know, when we think of the abolitionist movement, we think sometimes of Exeter Hall, which is where this used to sit on the Strand. And Frederick Douglass spoke to over 6,000 people there, and sort of extraordinary numbers. And when we read the newspapers, we can get this really lovely idea in some of these meetings about how hundreds came to listen to these men and women. Sometimes hundreds were turned away because there was physically not enough room to in that particular venue to listen to them. They were cramming all of the aisles. There's a really beautiful anecdote in Colchester in 1847, listening to one activist, where there was sort of 500 people crammed in this tiny church, and some people were turned away, and they basically came around the side of the church to crane their necks to listen through an open window. Going back into the actual venue, obviously you can try and imagine the heat of this sort of town hall or church with all these people packed in. And if a particular activist was obviously very passionate in their oratory, again, like someone like Frederick Douglass or William Craft, they would completely stir the audience, you know, to fits of passion themselves. You know, there are accounts where, you know, people are stamping their feet so loud that it almost rattles the windows. So you get these really beautiful sort of social history anecdotes here. But also, it's really important to note as well that there were some slightly negative reactions. As you can imagine, if those, again, like Samuel Ward, who mentioned that comment about British imperialism, if they were being very deliberate and wanted to accuse their British audience of their ignorance, of their lack of awareness, or the fact that, again, they were consuming slave-produced products, perhaps with that knowledge, that didn't necessarily go down well. So as these performances were obviously live, they were site-specific, it was almost like a theatre. That meant that if a particular activist said something that the audience didn't like, that meant that they were going to be interrupted, they were going to be shouted at, they were going to be, people were going to leave. And that happened several times. And depending on the ability of the lecturer, again, Frederick Douglass is just such a good example. He was interrupted once in a speech in London, and this particular man just didn't believe what he was saying. And he sort of interrupted Douglass and said, "Well, what is the price of a slave worth?" And Douglass instantly replies, the price of a slave in Louisiana is matched by the price of a pound of cotton in Manchester. And the guy is completely silenced because he can't compete with that that level of oratory. But the last thing I'll mention is, I mentioned Moses Roper earlier, and Roper exhibited those instruments of torture. He sometimes exhibited his own scarred back. And unlike some of the other activists that came around and traveled around the UK, he was incredibly graphic about the torture that he'd experienced. He would tell stories of how in one instance he was whipped 150 times, which resulted in his scarred and mutilated back, at the same time as holding up this particular whip. And as you can imagine, this, you know, was something very, very difficult to hear for this sort of almost sensitive white Victorian audience, sometimes middle class. And sometimes Roper's stories were so blunt, they were so graphic, that meant that the audience couldn't comprehend what Roper was saying. And demonstrating sort of quite a lot of sort of racial sort of paternalism, they basically decided that Roper wasn't a real survivor of slavery. They basically said, "Well, what you're saying is so untrue, I can't believe it. It's so unbelievable that therefore you must be making it up." And he was interrupted and shouted down. He was sometimes turned away from specific venues if somebody heard that, "Oh, this Roper is coming around and sharing lies." And again, Roper's story and this sort of story of inauthenticity was linked to the British abolitionist movement as well. There were a couple of British abolitionists who decided to ruin Roper's reputation in the British press and basically renounce him and make it harder for him to earn a living and also just to live in Britain and work safely. And that was because white British abolitionists couldn't understand or comprehend what Roper was saying.
That seems so contradictory in so many ways.
It is. I think the image that we have of the transatlantic abolitionist movement is that it was a very united movement, but actually it was just riddled with tensions. So it was riddled with tensions, you know, between the white anti-slavery societies, because I've been talking about Garrison a lot. I mean, he had obviously a lot of friends in all of these places around the British Isles. The Garrisonian movement believed that slavery should end immediately. It should end now. It should end absolutely now. And you know, to to stop the suffering of enslaved women, men and children. Now, there were other abolitionist movements both in the UK and in the US. There were groups that didn't believe slavery should be abolished immediately. There was sort of a movement where it was sort of preferred to be a more gradual approach. So, okay, let's pick a date in 5-10 years time where slavery can definitely end, but just sort of prepare for that. So there were those sorts of tensions. But there are also tensions that were firmly and based on race. And that's not something that we discuss or write about in terms of British abolitionists and American abolitionists. But just because you were an abolitionist, it did not mean that you were anti-racist or that you were free from the white privilege that obviously you bore. So the abolitionists who slandered and ruined Roper's reputation had no qualms about it. They demonstrated this sort of paternalism over visiting activists. So, for example, and another way this manifested itself was that if an individual came over to raise money to purchase their own legal freedom from slavery, or perhaps their family or brothers and sisters, mothers, fathers, daughters, children, British abolitionists decided, well, I will look after that money for you. You cannot be trusted to look after that money. So obviously there's a kind of strand of racism there. And again, there was an element of control as well with certain activists who came over. There was a sort of deliberate decision to try and control where they were going, where they shouldn't go, where they should try and publish their narratives, what they should say even on the anti-slavery sort of circuit. Again, Frederick Douglass, before he came to the UK, he was told by the abolitionist movement, stick to the facts, we will take care of the philosophy. So what they wanted was Douglass to stand up and share the facts of his enslaved life and to step back down again. Now, Douglass was a radical thinker and a philosopher in his own right, and he basically turned around and said, I felt like denouncing those facts. I didn't just feel like retelling those facts. I wanted to create a philosophy for myself. And he did that in the British Isles and also when he returned back to the US as well.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
If you were sort of a moral and if you were a true Christian person, not a Christian who had been sort of polluted by that sort of evil influence of slavery, then it was your duty to end it or to raise up your voice or to amplify the testimony of these women and men.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
When they were over here giving these amazing lectures, where were these people staying? Were they staying with families, with the organisers? How did that work?
Yeah, it's a really great question about networks, because I think it ties into what I was saying about the success of these anti-slavery tours. So for, again, someone like Roper, he was staying in, taverns or anywhere that he could basically get a room for the night because he didn't have that level of support. And he was visiting tiny, tiny rural villages in, in Wales and Cornwall and Scotland and places like that. So he was staying wherever he could get a room. people who had certain support. So again, some of the other men and women I've mentioned, Sarah Parker Remond as well, actually is another really interesting figure. They had support from William Lloyd Garrison or from American abolitionists who had connections in the US. So they would stay with these families. They would stay with friends in the movement. And sometimes they also stayed with each other. So William Allen Craft, who stayed here for 20 years, they lived in Hammersmith for a while. And Sarah Parker Remond, who came over to the British Isles and gave a lecturing tour. Sarah stayed with William and Ellen for a short time. So obviously, you know, these sort of networks of kinship and community and Black solidarity were incredibly important, and more important perhaps than obviously these shared white networks, because with those white networks and with those white abolitionists, although a lot of abolitionists were incredibly supportive of these figures, again, as I mentioned, they weren't free from that stamp of racism and white supremacy and white privilege. So staying with members of their own kinship and community, William Allen Craft and Sarah Parker Remond, had obviously that freedom to nourish each other and also have that solidarity between themselves.
And did their speeches, and I suppose also their presence, just their very presence in this country, did it have an effect? Can we trace the impact of these experiences?
Yeah, so impact's a really interesting question, because I think the first thing I'd say about that is that the British and Irish press were writing quite literally millions of words about their experiences. I mean, I've transcribed thousands of articles from, any publication that you can think of, from Cornwall all the way to Scotland. And they were writing quite a lot of coverage about their lectures and things like that. They were also raising support for... particularly if an individual came over and said, I need to raise X amount of money to legally purchase myself or members of my family. We can see that impact in that within a short few months, that money was raised instantly by ordinary, British and Irish people. We can also see the impact in the number of slave narratives that were sold. Frederick Douglass's slave narrative sold thousands of copies here. Moses Roper's sold 5,000 copies in Welsh and 20,000 copies in English within sort of 7 years. And even up to the 1870s, when Josiah Henson comes back over for a second time, his narrative sells nearly got a quarter of a million copies. So it's a really extreme and sort of wonderful, sort of demonstration of that impact. But one of the other stories, I think, which is really key to this level of impact is how women and men were able to use such controversies or events or particular instances to drum up support for the anti-slavery cause. So I mentioned the American Civil War. I think that obviously Britain didn't necessarily recognize the Confederacy, but I think the British and Irish public had a greater understanding about what the South fought for and what the Confederacy fought for near the end of the war because of these lectures, because thousands and thousands were going to hear, going to see and hear these women and men speak. But the other story as well, which is quite famous in Scotland, concerns the Free Church of Scotland. So I'll tell the story very briefly. In 1843, Thomas Chalmers and his band of supporters broke away from the established church to form the Free Church of Scotland. Now, he sent several ministers over to the US to raise some money for this new organization. And several of these missionaries actually went down to the southern states, and they received and accepted money from enslavers. They brought that money back, and that went into the coffers of the Free Church, into building Free Church buildings and into that church. Now, that happened obviously shortly before Frederick Douglass actually came to the UK, but when he did in 1845, he began lecturing about the Free Church, first in Belfast in the winter of 1845, but he really started this campaign called Send Back the Money in 1846. And while this did create a lot of criticism, the impact was incredible. There were songs and poems written about this Send Back the Money campaign. Douglass and two Quakers Eliza and Jane Wigham actually climbed Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh and carved "Send Back the Money" in the hillside. They, the town halls and churches of Edinburgh and Glasgow, and lots of places like Aberdeen as well, and Paisley and Dundee in Scotland, they were crowding out these town halls and venues to go and listen to Douglas talk about the Free Church campaign. "Send Back the Money" was actually painted in red paint on some of the Free Church buildings, and tickets had to be sold to some of Douglas's meetings because the excitement was so high. And one of the reasons why this impact was successful and why this impact worked was Douglas's incredible oratorical ability, but he used his sort of position as a fugitive, person who had been enslaved, to make that connection between that bloodstained money, as he called it, that was now obviously going into the profits of the free church. And he basically described how Southern Christianity was so corrupted and polluted by slavery that it wasn't actually Christianity. You couldn't be a true Christian if you were an enslaver and raped or whipped your enslaved population. And yet these Free Church ministers had traveled all the way from Scotland, all the way to the US and back again. And they had taken that bloodstained money that Frederick Douglass used to say that should have gone for my education, and obviously put it in the Free Church buildings. Now, as a caveat to that, in terms of the Free Church never actually did send back the money, but as Douglas later wrote, that it didn't, obviously that was a shame that didn't happen, but it was more of a case of an example, a scenario in which he could make the people of Scotland aware, and also obviously around the British Isles in general, they could make them aware of slavery and how it wasn't just based in the US. It had, crept all the way over to the UK in a sort of myriad ways.
I think another facet of this that fascinates me is the idea that there's often very little, very small communities who have the experience of meeting these people from an entirely different culture and point of life. Can we trace how it perhaps changed those communities?
Yeah, it's a good question, one that's slightly harder to try and research. What I found as sort of reading through the newspapers or trying to go through archives is that the people who heard Douglas when they were a child or when they were a young person, they still remembered it decades later as, you know, Douglas was the best orator I've ever heard. And that effect, that the effect that he produced, but also the anti-slavery principles that he dispelled were within me that, you know, for the rest of my life. There were several black abolitionists like John Sella Martin and Douglas as well, who sometimes received donations from incredibly poor working class men and women. And John Sella Martin in particular is really moved by this because there was one woman who basically gave a shilling to Martin and just said, "My family have gone without something for weeks in order to save up this and give it to you." You know, so you had women and men who obviously had this extraordinary, they had such an extraordinary impact from these people. And there's also another really great anecdote where Henry Highland Garner is talking about the products of slavery, so obviously rice and cotton, and encouraging people to boycott tobacco and things like that. And a sailor stands up in one of his meetings and says, I've seen slavery before. I thought I knew what its evils were, but I never have understood what slavery is until tonight, until I've heard your testimony and your words, and I'm never ever going to smoke tobacco again. Now, obviously, we don't know whether that particular story is true. I would like to think it is, but I think that the way that these women and men are sort of making these kind of tiny sacrifices themselves, but also they demonstrate the impact of these men and women. And it's something that obviously we shouldn't forget, not only in terms of these very, very small impactful meetings, but also all of the meetings everywhere, whether it's in Wales or, you know, in London or Scotland. You know, we're walking past sites that are rich in black history, that we're walking past these sites on a daily basis, and they really show the sort of unrelenting campaign to try and teach the transatlantic public about the realities of slavery and to try and campaign for racial equality.
So did these formerly enslaved people from America keep coming after 1865?
Yes, they did. So while the slavery had been abolished legally in the US, obviously that didn't mean that slavery had been slavery or its legacies had been abolished sort of through society, obviously the political sphere, and the culture of the South, but also the US as a whole. So African Americans continued to come to the British Isles after 1865 to, again, educate the British and Irish public that those legacies were still with them. So there was obviously rising racism, racial violence, particularly with lynching. You had thousands of African American women, men, and children who were murdered by white mobs, and obviously without any reason at all, apart from the fact that they were black, and these white mobs were trying to exert obviously their power, their white supremacy over that particular community. So men and women like Ida B. Wells is really a famous example. She came over in 1893 and 1894 to discuss anti-lynching and the anti-lynching movement. And she traveled around Britain and stopped in places like Birmingham and Manchester and Aberdeen and also in London to really to educate these audiences. There were some sort of temperance advocates as well, and some reformers who came to raise money specifically for the construction of black churches, black schools, you know, for adults and for children as well. And you had others who came to discuss and just basically sort of educate about segregation as well, sort of the ordinary segregational practices of the US, whether that was on transport, whether that was in education, health, employment, and things like that.
And how would you like people to look back at this period and have a different understanding of how these two nations interacted?
I think what I would like people to remember most is that these African Americans were sharing their testimony all around Britain. They were making radical and politicized journeys to the British Isles, often at the expense of their own personal health and trauma. So a lot of the men and women who were coming over were giving exhausting lecturing tours. They were speaking for 2 or 3 hours per night, sometimes every night for months. And that obviously didn't include the exhausting railway travel, which obviously was coming in and was popular obviously in the UK and, you know, in parts of the UK in the 1840s and 50s. But obviously the journeys were still very arduous and still very long. They were recounting such traumatic experiences, the torture that they that had been enacted upon themselves, but also that they had witnessed. They're also experiencing all these microaggressions, racial microaggressions with white abolitionists and also just the white British and Irish public. So I think that's really, really important to remember. But I think that every single speech they gave across the 19th century was designed to highlight and shine a light on the evils of slavery, how it operated in the US, but obviously how racism and white supremacy operated in the transatlantic sphere in both the US and the UK, and how their testimony and their messages were sort of reflected back to the US. I think that it's this really odd moment in abolitionist history that in Britain, we tend to focus on white abolitionists. We tend to focus on Thomas Clarkson, obviously, you know, most obviously William Wilberforce. And that's obviously a lot earlier in the century and obviously in the late 18th century as well. In the US, there is a focus on several white abolitionists and almost a complete ignorance about black abolitionists traveling over to the UK, obviously, although there's been some great scholarly works on it too, but in terms of the public knowledge, that necessarily isn't so much there. So I'd really, really love it if obviously people both on both sides of the Atlantic could obviously recognize that these African American activists were going all the way over to the British Isles to share this sort of really radical message about what it meant to be part of almost a global sort of citizenry, in that if you were sort of a moral, and if you were a true Christian person, not a Christian who had been sort of polluted by that sort of evil influence of slavery, then it was your duty to end it, or to raise up your voice, or to amplify the testimony of these women and men to go obviously back to the US, and for it to have a real impact and a real effect on the movement towards abolition there.
That was Hannah Rose Murray. As I said at the start, you can read her article in the August issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now and also includes pieces on medieval dynasties, the Emperor Nero, the US civil rights movement, and scare stories of Victorian London. And if you'd like to read more about Hannah Rose Murray's work, then do check out her website, frederickdouglasinbritain.com. And that's all for today. This podcast was produced by Ben Ewart and Jack Bateman. Do join us again on Friday when Michael Lewis will be discussing some extraordinary archaeological discoveries.